What do you do when a patient with borderline personality disorder storms out of your office or comes in on a long list of medications that they swear by but look to you like a rational polypharmacy? Lois Choi Keene offers up some answers in today's interview. Welcome to the Carlatt Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlatt Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psychiatric nurse practitioner and a dedicated reader of every issue.
The idea came from Robert Michaels, a psychoanalyst, psychiatric provocateur, and a longtime editorial advisor to the American Journal of Psychiatry. He was reviewing a paper for that journal on dialectical behavioral therapy back in around 2008. It was one of those pivotal randomized controlled trials, the type that are meant to show that DBT worked better than placebo. But Dr. Michaels saw something else. The placebo looked pretty good. This placebo was a thoughtfully designed approach to borderline personality disorder called good psychiatric management. And after 1 year of treatment, it worked as well as DBT, with similar reductions in self-harm, suicidality, and many of the core symptoms of the disorder. Michaels suggested that good psychiatric management was no placebo, but a legitimate therapy all its own, and encouraged the authors to develop it further. We are here today with one of those authors, Dr. Lois Choi Keene, and if you treat borderline patients but don't have a DBT center to refer them to, listen up. This therapy is for you. Unlike other evidence-based therapies for borderline, DBT, mentalization, and psychodynamic, good psychiatric management wasn't built on fancy theories. It developed out of John Gunderson's experience in working with borderline personality disorder over the past 40 years. It's very pragmatic, and it's meant to be used by everyday psychiatrists. It also addresses many of the problems that come up in the everyday care of borderline personality, things like medications, emergencies, comorbidities, and treatment goals. You can even use it if your sessions are spaced out every few months.
One thing I like about this therapy is that it tells you what not to do. Without that guidance, things can go really wrong with this disorder. In fact, that's how borderline personality was discovered in the 1960s. These were the patients who got worse with the therapy of the day, psychoanalysis.
When these patients laid back on the psychoanalytic couch and started free associating, things got real bad real fast. They decompensated, developed persecutory fantasies about their analyst. One started hallucinating that snakes were crawling up her analyst's chair, and as the analysis went on, their lives fell apart more. That was only supposed to happen to psychotic patients. Analysts had learned by then not to put psychotic patients on the couch. But it wasn't supposed to happen to neurotic patients, which is how these borderline cases first appeared at the first interview. And thus the term borderline was born. They were thought to be on the border of psychosis and neurosis. The lesson in that history is that you can't just jump into this type of treatment with good intentions and the standard therapy tools of the times. Our June-July double issue features a couple articles on borderline personality disorder, and today we'll bring you select clips from our interview with Dr. Lois Choi Keene. Dr. Choi Keene worked with Dr. Gunderson to develop good psychiatric management for borderline personality disorder, or GPM for BPD, to use some of the abbreviations you'll hear in this episode. Sadly, Dr. Gunderson passed away last year from cancer. He was a pioneer in the borderline field and helped transform this disorder from a psychoanalytic concept to a scientifically validated DSM diagnosis. Let's start with some clips from him on the key symptoms of borderline that he helped get into the DSM.
Definition involves three different sectors of psychopathology. The first and most discriminating involves the interpersonal relationships. Borderline patients have intense, unstable relationships marked by shifts between idealizing someone and devaluing someone, and marked by vacillation between over-involvement and dismissal or under-involvement. They also have fears of abandonment and fears of rejection, which are the phenomena reflecting a real fear about being alone. Some, including myself, feel that that is really where the core of this disorder is in the interpersonal area. A second major sector of psychopathology has to do with affective lability or emotional dysregulation as it's become identifiable through dialectical behavior therapy. But this includes a tendency towards angry outbursts or inappropriate anger. Many patients will say that they're always angry or that they can't control their anger. Mood changes that you could say are something that might characterize people with bipolar disorder, but in borderline patients, it characteristically involves feelings of anger and is characteristically very reactive to a social context. It's not like the moods change because of some internal clock that is pushing the moods back and forth, but is very responsive to the social context and in particular to adverse interpersonal events. And a third part of that affective picture is emptiness. Not all borderline patients will describe it. Those who do describe it, it seems in listening to life histories as if it's something that developed as a result of a long-standing sense of being neglected, so that there's an inner emptiness like a hungry child who has not been fed enough. The third sector of psychopathology belongs to the behavioral problems, and here deliberate self-harm, recurrent suicidal ideation and or acts is sort of the signal symptom of borderline personality disorder. Borderline patients often do hurt themselves and hurt themselves repeatedly. The more they do that, the more apt they are to be suicidal. Self-harm acts are both something that are self-punitive and a way of easing this dysphoric states of mind that they can't relieve otherwise. It also can become a call for help, a way of eliciting supportive responses from others. The other behavioral symptom has to do with patterns of impulsivity. The borderline patients typically have unsafe sex, drive recklessly, in addition are frequently bulimic or substance abusing. So that's the behavioral realm. The last realm has to do with cognition. And here, borderline patients, and this is why they were originally thought maybe to be an atypical form of schizophrenia, can have these lapses of reality testing. For instance, they can be like paranoid ideas. But the paranoid ideas usually occur when a borderline patient feels otherwise alone. And the idea that somebody's watching them actually is a psychological way of not being alone. They'd rather have somebody watching them than being alone. They can also have sort of hallucinogenic type phenomena when these are people who may have trouble going to sleep at night because they're alone and they may hear voices under those circumstances. I say they're not really psychotic because they reverse very quickly when you put the borderline person in a social context where there's other people around paying attention to them. So that's the definition, more or less as it's been since 1978 and in the diagnostic system since 1980. One thing I haven't mentioned is a disturbed sense of self, a sense that they're not really stable. It changes. A lot of borderline patients will say that I behave a lot depending on who I'm talking to or who I'm with and what I perceive they want or what they expect from me. So ill-formed and unstable identity. There's an argument could be built that that is a sort of blanket problem and everything else is subsumed within that.
And now for Dr. Lois Choi Keen.
What are your top do's and don'ts for communicating with people with BPD?
I think the top do's are to be honest and direct with patients who have BPD. There is an understandable irony in the tact that most people take with patients who have BPD because of their sensitivity to stress and to relationships. Many well-meaning individuals end up walking on eggshells and being very careful about what's said. What is ironic about that is that patients with BPD tend to be mistrustful of others. And they also happen to be so sensitive to others that they are very good interpreters of facial expression. So when well-meaning people try to cover up negativity or negative emotion by being overly nice or being one-sided about how they're really feeling in any given situation, I think there is like a long-term disservice to the ability the patient has to trust that person if they get the sense that they're not being told the whole truth. So I think that the burden of responsibility is on us as clinicians to figure out effective ways to communicate how we feel and what we're thinking to a patient. From the point of view of GPM, it's compatible with paying respect for the patient to have confidence that they can manage what you have to say. And if they get upset about it, then that's understandable. Then you aim to understand their upset feelings that may be completely reasonable within the context of the situation.
Can you speak more about the importance of nonverbal communication? I'm thinking, for example, of research where they may be more prone to misread certain neutral faces.
Absolutely. That's what I was thinking as well, Chris, is that traditional techniques of neutrality within, for instance, psychoanalysis or other approaches may be particularly hard for people who have borderline personality disorder because they care so much about what other people think. So they are more likely to be sensitive to negative facial expressions, and they may be quite good at reading those, maybe better than most people. But when it comes to neutral faces, they have much more difficulty. So when you're being too neutral or vague, it can be very difficult for the person with borderline personality disorder to know where you stand. And at the end of the day, they really actually do want to know that. And clinicians can understand their intense emotional reactions as just a product of them having BPD rather than a personalized response. But GPM would definitely not refrain from telling a patient something that you would want anyone else to know to manage their situations optimally and what they would need to know to have a stable relationship with you as a clinician.
They say, strike while the iron is cold. Do you have to be mindful of the timing and the heat, the temperature, the emotional temperature, and how you release this information?
I do think that patients with BPD are wanting to know what's on your mind, whether the temperature is hot or cold. Actually, they may want to know more when the temperature is hot. And one of the major areas of psychoeducation within good psychiatric management is to teach them about how their symptoms and their reactions may fluctuate with engagement of the other person. So in this model of BPD as a problem of interpersonal hypersensitivity, when people with BPD are feeling really connected and secure in their relationship with somebody else, they tend to be very collaborative and appreciative of that other person, but also sensitive to looking out for cues of threat or signs of rejection or disapproval. So it's not exactly a steady place to be, but it's a collaborative place. And when they feel like there's a real or perceived threat to that relationship and feeling so connected, that's when they become more hot, so to speak. They feel threatened in their stability because they need that other person. So they may become more angry, devaluing, and self-harming at that point in time. And that is where we would suggest that one leans into being more involved in working it out, even though that may be anti-intuitive, but doing it in a way that shows concern and investment in the stability of the relationship rather than one that's equally hot and dysregulated or emotionally driven. Because what can happen is that when the patient becomes more angry and threatened or threatening, this can cause other people to naturally withdraw. And it's when the patient is more alone and hard to reach that very little can be done in a definitive mode of treatment. And that's when they become more at risk for actual suicide attempts. And this is where unilateral action tends to be taken, that the person has to be hospitalized or the person themselves takes unilateral action in doing something more seriously reckless and self-damaging. So for that reason, we really encourage people to strike while the iron is hot, but not with another hot iron.
So when a patient with borderline explodes in our office, we need to think about what they might be threatened by and how they might be disconnected from us.
Yeah. And it really is the tack that you take to say, wow, I've really upset you. And if you know what it is, asking about it. Is it that I asked you to give me this homework I've asked you for when you've just explained to me that you've had a very difficult week? You know, so being able to be understanding about why the person is so upset. And that teaches the person that they're completely reasonable for being upset. But if you want someone else to be involved, that there are more optimal ways of engaging others.
Dr. Choi Keene has more tips on navigating relationships with borderline patients in our online interview. Relationship problems are the core feature of borderline personality disorder, and they are usually driven by a symptom called interpersonal hypersensitivity. That means intense emotional distress in the face of real or perceived relationship problems, or in the face of loneliness. Here's John Gunderson on interpersonal hypersensitivity.
The borderline condition, the way I describe it, is that it is a condition for people who grew up feeling that they did not get their needs met, with the hope that if they could form the proper relationship, that that would solve their problems. And so when they enter their adolescent and young adult years, they try to form exclusive relationships with someone. And that invariably creates tension. The other person will feel like they're getting swallowed up. So they withdraw, and then the person with borderline personality disorder will get very anxious about this. And the anxiety takes the form of angry devaluation. You never cared. All you said was a lie. I can't count on you. I should never have trusted you. What we call angry devaluation. And it alternates with, there's something inherently wrong with me. Now, as when I was a child, nobody can really love me and give me what I need. And there's something wrong and bad about myself. And it's under those circumstances that the person can become self-destructive, oftentimes cutting or burning or other forms of deliberate self-harm occur under those circumstances. They originally start out as a way of coping with this sense of badness, taking mental pain and converting it into something physical, but it gets converted with time into a cry for help. When it becomes something that's recognized by school teachers, friends, family, they oftentimes get a lot of solicitous attention. Then they're back into the situation where somebody really cares and they're needy, idealizing, hopeful, and they can imagine that they are a good person and that they are lovable. And it starts all over again. They become very dependent on the attention from that other person. And then when it's broken, the cycle starts again. That's my way of understanding this disorder.
Now, I fielded some questions from our editorial board. This one came up a lot, and I think here the readers are looking for specific words you can say to a patient that are compassionate as you set the boundaries of phone use and contact between visits.
The most useful stance to take with observing and describing your limitations in terms of your availability to the patient is to really frame it in terms of your own operations, your own need for predictability and stability, and your own strengths and weaknesses. So being able to be open but candid with the patient and saying that these are the reasons that I am available for you outside of sessions, but not these other reasons. So if you are very specific about call me when you're feeling suicidal or when you don't know what to do about a situation that's at urgent risk to you, keeping that door open, but then really outlining what the limitations are, is that you can't be available after a certain time of the evening, and making that about your own inability to be useful or effective at that time of day, or your own difficulty sustaining such availability. Being able to say, part of this is that I want to be very consistent with you and be professional, reliable, and predictable so that we can sustain a productive relationship going forward. And I find that oftentimes my being more vague or inconsistent about the reasons people contact me is a setup for problems for the patient.
Thank you, Dr. Choi Keen.
Dr. Lois Choi Keen is the director of the Gunderson Personality Disorders Institute at Mass General's McLean Hospital. You can learn more about good psychiatric management for borderline personality disorder in a 2019 text from APA Press. The clips of John Gunderson were generously provided by Rebby Ratner, the director of a wonderful documentary about borderline personality disorder. You can watch it online at borderlinethefilm.com. And now for the word of the day, projective identification.
Projective identification is a defense mechanism that derives from Melanie Klein's object relations theory. This is one of the defense mechanisms you need to know, because you'll see it in borderline patients, and if you don't get wise to what's happening, it can quickly blow up. This is when patients take their own personal qualities that are unacceptable to them, such as dishonesty, selfishness, aggression, and project them onto their clinician. Like if I were to yell at my psychiatrist for being an angry, hateful person, when what's really going on is that I can't deal with my own hatred and anger. So that's step one, projection. But projective identification takes it one step further. In this dance, the patient starts to act in a way that practically turns the psychiatrist into the angry, hateful person that they imagine them to be. In jargon-free speech, it's known as self-fulfilling prophecy or gaslighting. A sign of projective identification is that you're having feelings that aren't usual for you in practice, intense feelings like anger or sexual attraction. And that's when you need to pause and figure out what's going on so you don't act on them. Here's how it might look in practice. A patient comes in and fires you like this.
I just can't work with a doctor who is as self-centered as you. I called your answering service all night and never heard from you.
Before you can explain that you tried to call back but their cell wouldn't pick up, she throws her bill in your face.
I'm never going to pay for this. You can eat it.
Then, calm as a cucumber, she walks out of the room, tipping over your antique lamp and breaking it in the process. She's calm because she's projected all her anger onto you. Meanwhile, you are furious and hire a collections agency to go after her for the bill, tacking on the cost to replace the lamp. You've never used a collections agency before, but this one really stung. And that is part of why Dr. Choi Keen emphasizes we need to treat borderline patients much like we would other patients. Watch out for times where you are overly nice, offering free sessions or extra time, or overly harsh, like in the story above. Those are the boundary crossings that can end up in an accident.
You can learn more about good psychiatric management for borderline personality disorder in our June-July double issue, which has a useful table on all the do's and don'ts. And you'll get $30 off your first year subscription with the promo code PODCAST.
Join us next week where we'll bring you unpublished reports from the International Bipolar Disorders Conference, which just wrapped up yesterday, including an unpublished breakthrough for bipolar depression.
And thank you to all our subscribers for helping us stay free of advertising, industry support, and other kinds of insidious boundary crossings.